you haven't picked up your exam two paper, you can do that in the box outside my office door. If you have a regrade request, you definitely don't want to put that in the box outside my office door, because that's outgoing, not incoming. I never look in there for something that is for me. So you want to put any regrade request either in my hand in the Balsamo mailbox that's for me, for the beside the main office in the quad level of Balsamo. Or you can slide under my office door. But if you leave it in that box, I'll never see it. Okay? So we're through exam two. And this is usually a bit of a stressful time for some members of this class. And so I will open it up to questions, issues, suggestions. So the question is, are the regrade requests due by a certain day? Yeah, we would like to make certain that anything you want me to consider be in my hand by sort of at least the time to take the final exam. I don't have a deadline. I really strongly suggest that you pick up your exam, that you go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and you see if there's a mistake, and go ahead and get it to me so you don't forget. Okay. But if you discover something in the process of studying for the final or whatever, and you want to give it to me, that's fine. I'll take it, and I'll consider it. Again, with the regrade requests, right, I mean, I'll look at them, I'll consider them. Sometimes it may seem unfair, even I'll agree that it might be unfair, but because I know the TAs did it a certain way and I want consistency, I may or may not change it. But, you know, I certainly do sometimes change grades because of the regrade requests. So we can try to get that right. Anything else? Okay, so I know many of you may be thinking about the class or pondering the class, etc. You know, if you have issues or suggestions that you want to bring to my attention that you really don't want to bring up here, that's fine. You're welcome to bring that up with me via email or walk in my office. If you want to keep it anonymous, write it on a piece of paper and slip it under my door, that's fine. So, okay? I have to say that, you know, if you have ideas for something that would work better for you, you let me know. I would say that probably 80% of the structure of this class has come from students basically giving me good feedback about things that work or don't work for them. All right, so last time we started in, we've been talking about rotational motion. And so just a little reminder that, you know, we have this linear world that we're very used to now, and we have a relationship, if you look at rotational motion, between the linear world driven by what's happening along sort of the arc length, if you want to think about it, as something that's rotating, and the angular world, which is basically the angle through which it rotates. And they're related by S is equal to R theta. So this is really a fundamental equation that, it'll be on the formula sheet, but I hope after you've done a few problems, you'll automatically know that one. Take the derivative, you get D is equal to R omega, where omega is the angular velocity, A is equal to R alpha, alpha is the angular acceleration. And you really have to have things in angular language, because in linear language, things are complicated if you go along the radius of something that's rotating, right? Because an object that is far away, if it rotates through the same angle, has to move faster. So the linear thing really has this linear scaling that's complicated, right? So this is the relationship between the linear and angular world. And so we take the sets of equations we've dealt with for linear one-dimensional kinematics, and we can find the angular analogs, which you've now hopefully been playing with. In addition, and last time we talked more about this, we have the basic Newton's second law, which gives us the fundamental physics that drives what makes these things happen largely. It's a relationship between force, mass, and acceleration, F equals ma. And we've developed the the rotational analog of that, torque is equal to I alpha. Okay, so torque is this strange, it does contain force, but it also contains the distance from the axis of rotation. Okay, and as we get into later in this class, there's even a bit of a more complication in that it's only the piece of the force that is at right angles to that connecting axis that causes rotation. The piece that's along the axis, the piece of the force which is along the line of action that passes through the axis, does nothing for rotation. Okay, so torque is a bit complicated. We talked about the angular mass, which we call the moment of inertia. Again, if you think about the linear thing, mass is sort of the reluctance of something to accelerate for a given force. So moment of inertia is sort of the reluctance of something to rotate for a given force. Okay? If it is heavier, it's harder to get it to rotate. So the moment of inertia contains the mass. If the mass is distributed very far out, it is harder to rotate, even if the mass is the same. So this moment of inertia contains usually basically r squared, where r is the distance of the bit of mass from the axis. Depending on the exact shape, I can vary. So you either have to calculate I, which we've looked at, or you have to look it up in the table, which will be given to you. Okay? Alpha is the angular acceleration, so it's the equivalent of A in the angular world. In the linear world, we have the measure of translational kinetic energy, 1/2 mv². If we look at the angular analog to that, you basically map m into I and v into omega. It's 1/2 I omega². In any problem, if something is moving or rotating, you can have kinetic energy associated with either of those, and so you have to take that into account. If you have a body that is translating and rotating, and you only put the 1/2 mv² term in, you've screwed up on the energy conservation, because you have kinetic energy associated with rotation. Okay, so you have to take that into account. And it has an effect. Okay, so let us try one of these quicker things. So you should be able to select one and one. And while you're joining, I'm going to go over the problem with you. So I have 5 different masses. Assume that they all have exactly the same mass and that their density is uniform throughout. Around for each of these 5, I have shown axes. So as an axis that goes through the symmetry for this hoop, the point of symmetry for this cross, going through from one corner to another for a cube, down the middle of a cylinder, and up through the middle of a sphere. Okay? So consider those to be the axes of rotation. Having that information, I would like you to tell me which of these objects you believe has the largest moment of inertia. Okay. Okay, so look at that and decide which letter you would like. Rotate it about axis B, right? So in the one case, if you imagine this is a wheel, I'm rotating about that axis. In the other case, I'm rotating about the end, right? you can go to the table and you can find out that the, or you can calculate that the moment of inertia about axis A is equal to 1/2 times the mass of the object times r squared. There is something which is known as the parallel axis theorem. Which you will see in your book, which tells you that the moment of inertia about an axis which is parallel to one where you already know the moment of inertia is equal to the moment of inertia in the one that you know plus mr squared, where r is the distance between those two axes. In this case, if you think about it, if this object is uniform, it has a center of mass right at the center of this thing. And we've already sort of motivated that if you have a point-like mass, the moment of inertia of that going down an axis is mr squared. So what you have here is, this is telling you that the moment of inertia about this axis is equal to the moment of inertia about this axis plus the moment of inertia of that massive point around that axis, or that sort of motivation for it. If I were to make you do something with this on test, I'll sort of lead you through that, okay? So I'm not, but you will see it in the book. There might be a problem or two that involves it, I don't know. But I wanted to at least show it to you. So in this case, the moment of inertia around B is going to be equal to 1/2 mr squared plus mr squared, which is 3/2 mr squared. Whenever you're thinking about moments of inertia and you have to think of something like this, you can always ask yourself at least whether the relative sizes make any sense. I mean, if I gave you a solid wheel and you had to spin it about that axis or spin it about that axis, which one's going to be easier to spin? I mean, the center one, because the mass is relatively close to the axis. Here, you have a lot of mass now distributed much further away. So you're going to have a larger moment of inertia for this wheel. No, it is not obvious what that moment of inertia is. That's why you have to calculate it. And the easiest way to calculate it is to do this kind of thing. But this moment of inertia, then, is much larger than that moment of inertia. Yes?
Does that parallel axis have to be at the very edge?
It could be anywhere. It's just parallel anywhere. You can't actually talk about moments of inertia of something rotating about an axis that is not even touching. In principle, I mean, maybe it's sort of crazy to think of it that way, but you could. So you could set up a problem where you have a really thin but strong support that's effectively negligible and has some mass way out here. Talk about moment of inertia about that axis. So it's quite general.
So, yes. So if the second axis is parallel axis, where say halfway between B and A, would you use the?
This would be m times basically be 1/2 r. Yeah, in fact, I think the way I have it drawn, it's a little deceptive. This I'm going to put as r squared, where this r is defined to be the distance between the two axes. That'll probably be a little bit clearer. Okay? You to have seen that, and I don't think I'll beat you over the head with it. So let's move on. Okay. Up until now, for all of the Newton's law problems that we've done, if they involve pulleys or something like that, we have tried to be very careful to state that the pulleys are massless and frictionless. And I think that wording seems like excess baggage. Generally, until now, okay? Because what we have now is, what I'd like to do is now have this be a frictionless pulley, but it has mass. So it's now a wheel that has a radius that we're going to say R0. And we hang two masses, M1 and M2, on either side of that pulley. And we have a string which we'll consider massless and it doesn't stretch, etc. So I want to do an example problem to give you a feeling for how this kind of thing factors into this problem. So let's set mass 1 equal to 35 kilograms, mass 2 equal to 38 kilograms. So we'll say the pulley is a uniform circular, uniform cylinder. And you can imagine a wheel, which is a disc, because a cylinder is just sort of stubby, okay? It's not, so people, you'll often see these described as cylinders. Has a radius of 0.3 meters, and it has a mass. It's uniform, has a mass. This is going to be in your table. All right, you can look it up. We're going to say that initially we have M1 on the ground, and M2 is at rest. So we have it all sitting here just supported momentarily, where M2 is 2.5 meters above the ground. So we assume that the rope is massless and does not slip. Why do I say does not slip?
Static.
Yeah, it does mean static friction is at work between the rope and the pulley. Imagine what happens if the rope slips, but there is no friction. The rope slips. It is the massless case. That it's irrelevant, that the mass of the pulley becomes irrelevant because the rope just slips on it. It doesn't rotate the pulley. So usually you'll have a little weasel wording in these types of problems, and they will tell you the rope does not slip. That is really important. And the reason it is important is because it marries the rotational degrees of freedom of this thing to the linear degrees of freedom that you have here. If this mass drops down an inch, this thing has to rotate such that you have 1 inch of the arc length over, because it has to supply that much linear rope to the mass that's falling. That only happens if you basically have this rope not slipping. If it moves at a certain velocity, the outer edge of that pulley has to move at the same velocity. Okay? So it's really essential, because that's what maps the angular world onto the linear world. So in this problem, then, the system is released, and we want to know what is the speed of this mass when it hits the ground. And one of the things that I think students find frustrating with physics when they're first getting involved with it is that there are sometimes multiple ways to do problems. So you do something and you're not really sure you did it the so-called right way. And when you're first entering this field, what you want to do is learn how to do the right answer. Well, sometimes there are multiple ways to do it, perfectly good things, perfectly good ways to do it. So in this case, I'm going to solve it two ways. And the first way I don't want to spend a lot of time on, so I just went ahead and wrote it up for you. It may be tapped on your notes, I don't know, but it saves us a lot of time if I do this for things I don't want to spend a lot of time on. Alright, so in this case, if we look at the picture and remember that the rope doesn't slip, what's going to happen? We let this go, this mass is heavier, so it begins to fall, it accelerates down, this one goes up, and this thing begins to rotate clockwise relative to you, okay? So we can use energy conservation if we'd like. The pulley doesn't change in height, so there's no change in gravitational potential energy for it. One mass starts out with effectively zero, if we define the zero of the height to be the floor. One mass starts out with zero potential energy, that's B mass one. It rises to a height, which will be 2.5 meters. The other mass falls 2.5 meters. Okay, so each of these masses has a change in gravitational potential energy from the initial state to the final state. In addition, what you're asked to find is, you have this situation, and as this mass goes down, what you're asked to find is the velocity of this mass at the very instant before it hits the ground. Okay? So, the masses are both moving at that point. So in the initial state, they're at rest, no kinetic energy. In the final state, they're both moving. So each will have kinetic energy. So each has potential energy and kinetic energy. If it were a massless pulley, that would be all you need to solve the problem. In this case, the pulley also has mass. Initially, it is not rotating, so it has no kinetic energy. In the final state, it is rotating, and it has to rotate in such a way that the linear speed on the outside of that pulley matches the linear speed of the masses. So that's sort of the idea. So if we look at the total energy you have to begin with, nothing's moving, nothing's rotating, and all you have is this one mass that's up high. So that would be the total potential energy you have. So it'd be mass 2. I should actually just bring the drawing over from the other page so we have it. So initially, all we have in terms of energy is N2, which is at a height of 2.5 meters. So we'll call it MGH, N2GH. As that energy is transformed into other things, where does it go? That initial energy goes into the gravitational potential energy of M1 as it rises, so that would be M1 times G times H. Because the string doesn't stretch, this goes up as high as that one goes down, so that's why I know the height is H. They're both moving at the last instant before N2 hits the ground, so I have the kinetic energy terms for each mass. M1 V1 squared N2 V2 squared. If you stop and think about it, if the string doesn't break or stretch, those velocities have to be the same because they're sort of married together. So I write them as 1 and 2 here, but they're really the same. And then this thing is now rotating at the very end, and it will rotate with a kinetic energy 1/2 I omega squared. You can look up in a table for a cylinder that I is equal to 1/2 mR0 squared. So that tells you what I is. And then omega, because it's not slipping, the angular velocity of this thing is related to the linear velocity at that radius by S is equal to R theta, V is equal to R omega. So V here is equal to R0 times omega. So omega squared becomes V squared over R0 squared. So if I take this term and I substitute in for I, here's I, put it here, 1/2 mR0 squared. I substitute in for omega, which is V over R. I square them because I have a square for omega squared. And now I have an equation. I'm given the masses. I don't have the velocity. I am given the height, and I'm given R0. You can just algebraically now solve for V. It's a quadratic, so you end up with plus or minus. And actually, depending on how you define your up or down, clearly it's going to be going down. So, okay? Any questions on that? So that would be energy conservation. Now let's learn to solve it a different way. What I'd like to do now is to basically use Newton's laws. And I want to to solve this in a way that we have solved Newton's law problems in the past. And if the left-hand mass goes up, for example, I'll define that as my positive y direction. But note that if that happens, the right-hand mass is moving down, and I would like the sign convention to be consistent between the two. So for the right-hand mass, I'll call that a plus y. In addition, what you'll notice is if those two are moving in a plus y direction, then it's going to cause this pulley to rotate clockwise. So I'm going to consider rotation this way as positive rotation. So that way, when I talk about an angular acceleration here, it's positive, it maps onto a linear acceleration that is positive at the edge, and it's all consistent. Okay? And that's important, because if you have one of these backwards, if you don't flip the sign in the right place in the equation, you're going to have everything. And this is the simplest way to do it, is to go ahead and take care of that initially. So, the next step in these types of problems is to look at the free body diagrams. And let's see, we have M1 on the left and M2 on the right. So let's look at M1. We know that the force of gravity is acting on it, so we have M1G is a force that's down. The force that's up is the tension in the rope. And that's it for mass one. It doesn't care whether the pulley's massless or not. Okay, it's just, we only look at the forces on it. For mass two, we have the force of gravity down on that, M2G, and we have the tension up. Is this tension the same as the tension on the other side? Absolute value of the tension on the left side the same as the absolute value of the tension on the right hand side. If the pulley is massless, you should all know that it is, right? The pulley is massive, right? If the tensions are identical, why is that pulley ever going to rotate? If I pull here with as much force as I pull there, the pulley just sits there. Okay? So if this is going to rotate, I know that I have to have an unequal torque on it. I have to have a net torque, which basically means the force here has to be different from the force there, which tells you the tension here is different from the tension there. Okay? In the linear world, you may recall the type of problem that you've seen a few times where, imagine I have three masses hanging on a rope, and this whole thing is accelerating with the acceleration A upward. How does the tension here compare to the tension here? What do you think?
The upper segment has greater tension.
All right.
There's more mass flow. For the first block.
Yes. So each of these blocks, if you write a free body diagram for them individually, the net force has to be Ma upward for each of them. Okay? So that means the tension here only has to be equal to Ma for that block. The tension here has to be enough to both carry that block and that block, because imagine I put a shoebox around, I think of them as one block, so it'd be basically two MA. This one, this has to support all three, okay? So I hope that's not news to you. We've sort of been doing problems like that. This is really the same thing, okay? This tension has to be enough not only to accelerate this thing up, but it has to be enough to also accelerate to be a torque to cause that to rotate, okay? So the moment you say that there's a mass in the pulley, it breaks this notion that we have that the pulley doesn't adjust the tension to go across. And it's absolutely critical. Because if you now, in a problem like this, call those the same tension, you're going to end up solving a massive pulley problem, and it's not going to be right. Okay. So it's very important to note that. So that means when you're doing the free body diagrams, you go, aha, I know, that's a different tension. So you call it something else. I don't really care what, but I'll usually put it prime or something like that. Okay. And now we need to also do a free body diagram for the pulley. And you might say, okay, the pulley has mass, so it has gravity down, and it has sort of these ropes pulling on it. But it's not going anywhere. It's rotating. So even though it has mass and you have ropes pulling down on it, it's basically pegged to the wall by some rod that has some unspecified normal force going up that will keep it from translating. Okay, it's just allowed to rotate. So for this problem, you don't have to worry about the translational aspect of it, but we do have to worry about the rotational aspects of it. So what we know is that we have a force here, which is equal to T, because along the length of the rope on the left-hand side, the tension's all the same. And we know that on the right-hand side, it's T prime. And those are unequal. And the fact is, you have some normal force, you have some mg, and nobody cares about this for this problem. And this thing has some radius r0. You okay with that so far? All right. So let's take. Oops. Let's take this one and look over here. What I'd like to do is write down the sum of the forces for it. So we know this thing is accelerating upward, so if I look at the sum of the forces in the Y for that left-hand free body diagram, that's equal to M1 times the acceleration that it has, which is what we're asked for, well, which is what we need to calculate the velocity at the bottom. That's going to be equal to T, which is in the positive Y direction, as we've defined it, minus M1 times G. This one, doing the same thing, the sum of the forces in the sum of the forces in the Y is equal to M2 times A. Again, if I assume A is positive when I have this type of motion, okay, then I have a positive sign in this equation. And that will be now equal to a positive M2G, because I've defined positive down, minus T prime. Oops, T prime. Are you okay with those two equations? All right. Now comes the new part, which is I want to do the equivalent thing for the rotating piece. And the equation that we use for rotation is that the sum of the torques is equal to I times alpha. Right? So I for the pulley times its angular acceleration has to be equal to the sum of the torques, and we have two torques. Remember, torque is force times lever arm, basically, from the axis. So we have one torque, which is this tension times R0. And I'm going to call it positive because this torque acts to rotate this thing such that the acceleration is going to be positive on the side. Okay? So I'm going to call that a positive torque. Then we have another torque on the left-hand side, which is this tension times R0 because it's the same lever arm. And I'm going to call this one negative because it acts to rotate it the other way. All right? So this will be equal to R0 T prime, which is positive, minus R0 T. Because the rope is not slipping, I know that alpha and acceleration are linearly are related by this, you know, A equals R alpha. So this, so we've said I for a wheel is 1/2 MR squared. So this I alpha is equal to 1/2 times the mass of the pulley times R0 squared times what alpha is in terms of linear A, which is going to be A over R0. So if I just rewrite this equation a little bit nicer, I have 1/2 times the mass of the pulley times R0 times A is equal to R0 T prime minus R0 T. So now I have this equation from the circular rotational piece, this equation from one mass for linear, that equation for the other mass for linear. I have three equations. What do I not know? I don't know the tensions, and in this case it isn't that I don't know a tension, I don't know either tension because they're two separate ones, and I don't know the acceleration. But I'm given the masses, I know g, I'm given the radius. Yes?
So does this
the acceleration does depend on the radius in this way. It is alpha that you have here, and when I substitute in, when I marry how the angular acceleration joins, is related to the linear acceleration, A is equal to R alpha, so alpha is equal to A over R0, so that's what I put in here. So I sort of have that dependence taken into account.
But it's solving the actual problem.
Solving what?
Like, I just feel like if that bottom corner is
linear, yeah,
the R's and all just go
away. They do.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Boom, boom, boom. So in that sense, yeah, it falls out of that equation. That's true. And I guess a way to think of, okay, actually that's a nice observation. It really is. Because what you know is that the moment of inertia changes as you sort of have a larger radius, because you've changed the distribution of the mass with a larger radius. And at the same time, you're also using the torque for each figure. So I guess in a sense you can conceptualize that sort of canceling out the radial piece here. But remember this also, this linear A, for a given angular rotation, that A is larger as you go out further than radius. So anyway. Namely, we have three equations and three unknowns, which I will leave to you to solve. I'll write down the answer for you. So when you do the algebra for this, what you'll find is that the linear acceleration is equal to m2 minus m1 times g over 1/2 times m, which is the mass of the pulley, plus m1 plus m2. And this is a constant acceleration. And you go, God damn, I'm done. Does it make any sense? Now's a good time to ask. Remember in this thing, I'll go ahead and bring the drawing over again. Is huge relative to m1. And this becomes m2 times g over effectively m2, and you have an acceleration of just g. Which makes sense, because if m2 is really, really big compared to all that, it's like you just drop it in the free fall. Sort of the same for m1. Although it doesn't really make sense, because if you let M2 go, you're not going to accelerate M1 if M1's huge. So, if the mass of the pulley is really big, it doesn't really matter how big M2 is relative to M1. You're just going to have a hard time getting that pulley to accelerate. So this sort of shows you that the acceleration gets small as M gets really big. All right, so in a sense, you have some idea this may make sense. Are the units correct? This is mass, this is all mass, those cancel, and I'm left with an acceleration. All right, so just a quick look at it can give you some sense that this acceleration is okay. You've now struggled to set up the free body diagrams. You've done this crap load of algebra, so you're not very happy about it. You're very happy to be done with it. You want to move on to the new problem. I didn't ask for the acceleration. I asked for the velocity of M2 when it hits the ground, right? So now you have to use that acceleration to calculate what was actually asked for. So when you put in the numbers for this problem, we find that A is equal to 0.4 meters per second squared, if I didn't make a mistake, all right? And now you can use your constant linear acceleration equation that the velocity of mass 2 when it hits the ground is equal to its initial velocity when it gets started squared plus 2 times its acceleration times the distance. Its acceleration is not g. The acceleration is the acceleration that we have calculated there. Okay. So this V02, it starts out with zero velocity, so that's zero. So V2 squared is equal to 2 times 0.4 times 2.5 meters, right? So this is equal to 2, so that V2 is equal to 1.4 meters per second, which, if I did the calculation right, when we used energy conservation, that's also what we got. Good about that? Question? Yes?
Which equation did you solve to get A?
I solved this equation to get A, to get the A, to get this form for the equation for A, I use these three equations simultaneously. This one represents the sum of the forces linearly on the left-hand mass. This represents the sum of the forces linearly on the right-hand mass. And this represents the sum of the torques on the pole. And those are three separate things. So it's really similar to what you've done in the past where you do the free body diagrams for each essential piece in the problem. But now you're putting in the rotational degrees of freedom for the things that rotate, which gives you this additional equation. And in this case, there happen to be three unknowns, so you can algebraically solve it. Okay? All right. Let me just sort of set up another one so you get a feeling for it. Imagine if we have an inclined plane with a pulley here. And we have these two masses. If the pulley has mass, I is not equal to zero. Okay? So, to set this thing up, we look at three free body diagrams. One would be the free body diagram of the object, which is on the inclined plane. Those are the three things you have to worry about. The other would be the free body diagram for the mass that's hanging. And the tension is different because, again, the pulley has mass. And then you can do the free body diagram for the pulley. Should at least be consistent with the colors. And so now we have T over here and T prime here. And then you do Newton's law, F equals ma. As usual over here. You do the same over here. And here in the middle, you use the sum of the torques. It is a vector, but we're not there yet. Is equal to I alpha, which is I alpha is equal to, say, if this thing has a radius little r, it's going to be r T prime minus RT if I define clockwise as positive. You do have to use consistency. If in this problem, for whatever reason, I define this direction as positive and that direction as positive, then I would do counterclockwise as positive and I would have this as RT minus RT prime for consistency. And then you look at these, and you look at what you know and you don't know, and hopefully you have an equation that you can solve. Okay? Table before a simple wheel attached to an axis. Okay. And if I drop it, it falls fast. Okay? Now what I'm going to do with this puppy is I'm going to wrap and roll up the strings. I'm going to let it go in a moment. What's going to happen? Basically, it's going to rotate, you can't even see it, but I rotate it in such a way that it will rotate like this on the way down. And then when it gets to the bottom, it probably will continue rotating that way until it sort of climbs back up a little, and then it will go back down. Yeah, that's what I expect. Well, let's see what else you might notice. Because there it's doing exactly what he said. Is it in free fall? What's happening with the energy? It's got to fall. Its acceleration has to be less than g, because if you think of it from an energy conservation point of view, you're converting gravitational potential energy into both the energy of translation of the thing, but also of rotation, and it has a big moment of inertia, so that's hard to get it going. Do another clicker problem. In this case, you might actually want to have a piece of paper available. This we'll call A, this B, C, D when we do this. Actually, take a moment. I have on the screen before you, I have a lovely drawing of a pulley that is frictionless, but it has mass, and it has a radius little r, and we have a string that does not slip, that is wrapped around this pulley. As the string is let out, you can ignore any changes in the radius of the pulley. Okay? I'm going to tell you that the moment of inertia of this cylinder, which is the pulley shape, okay, is 1/2 times mr squared. Here's big M. Which of these is the correct expression for the acceleration of this big mass as you drop it? Try calculating that. I'm going to give you a few minutes to look at that. Da 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 free to talk to other friends around if you want. By all means, look at their papers. In your mind which letter you would like. Have no clicker and you think it's A, raise your hand. You think it's B, raise your hand. You think it's C, raise your hand. You think it's D, raise your hand. So within the non-clicker crowd, we have sort of a split between C and D. Let's see what the clicker crowd says. It's more of a split between C and D, but C seems to be the winner. Okay, somebody chose C. Tell me why, how you thought about that. Did I always choose C because nobody ever puts the right answer at A? Did you think about that? Well, why C? Going on, trying to think through limited cases on this, and that's perfectly good, right? Anybody do it a little more systematically? Although there's some systematic aspects to that, right? And he really was thinking about the form of these and what would happen in limited cases, etc. So that by all means is a reasonable way to do this kind of problem. Of course, had I not given you equations and said, find A, that thinking doesn't help very much until you actually get the equation. So So what do you think? How is it?
You need better forces. I got mg over 1/2 little m times big mg over 1/2 little m plus big m. So if you multiply directly to do that, you get e.
Okay. Maybe I can't follow. But let's look at let me show you how I would like you to think about it. Which you may have done. I can't follow things quickly. Okay. Think about it this way. You've got two pieces to this problem. We've got pink. We don't want pink. We have the pulley of mass M that has a tension down on it, okay? It's not going to translate because it's pinned frictionlessly. I know that it's a pulley wheel, so I know that I is equal to 1/2 times M times its radius squared. If it's going to rotate, then the sum of the torques is equal to I times alpha. I here is this 1/2 mr squared. Alpha is going to be equal to a over r. So I can substitute in, and then what is the torque? The torque is going to be the force times its lever arm, r. All right? So I have tension times r is equal to 1/2 times mr squared times a over r. For tension is equal to 1/2 times ma. So that is the rotational piece. That's what we get from analyzing just that one piece. Now we look at the other block. It has a tension going up, mg going down. If we define down as positive, then we have mg minus t is equal to m. I should make these bigger m's. So we take this and substitute it in for tension. We get big M times G minus 1/2 little m times A is equal to big M times A. And you can rearrange things and you find that A is equal to 2 times big M G over 2 M plus M, which is E. And I guess they're, yes, times. Okay? That's the way to systematically think about it. Right? And now think about it for a moment. This rotation is different from that rotation. And we sort of know how to deal with that because this has a small omega and this has a big omega. You're with me? Notice though that this rotation is not the same as that rotation or this rotation. Right? The plane of rotation matters. That's the orientation. So we have to understand how to deal with that. So we do that by considering a vector. It may seem really strange to you, but I am able to take three-dimensional rotational motion and I can describe the omega by a single vector. Okay? Imagine that I have a wheel rotating, and imagine that we have a vector that points along the axis of rotation, like this. Okay? Let us let the magnitude of that vector represent the size of omega. That is, how fast it's spinning. Okay with that? The direction of this vector can specify the axis and the plane of rotation. Because if I'm rotating in this plane, yeah, it's pointing that way. This plane is rotated that way. This plane is rotated that way. Okay? So by just having this one vector, I can represent both how fast I'm spinning and the basic orientation. And there's one piece I haven't yet specified. And that piece is, am I rotating this way or am I rotating that way? So we do that by saying, if it is coming out this way, I'm rotating like that. And if I'm rotating like this, it goes that way. And you think, wait a minute, how do I figure that out? Okay? There's a technique that we use. Okay? Pretend you use your right hand. Please, everyone, hold up your right hand. Okay? If you're confused, with my back to you, it would be this one and not that one. And I will try to remind you about that before a test, because if you start doing this shit with your left hand, you're totally wrong. Okay? So what you do is, if the thing is rotating like this, you pretend to grasp the axis of rotation in such a way that your fingers go along the direction of the rotation. Like that. And when you do that, if your right hand is like most right hands, your thumb will be pointing out along the direction of omega for that rotation. Okay? If it is rotating the other way, now you put your fingers in the direction of rotation, and voila, your thumb points the other way. Okay? So that rule, which, because physicists are so spiffy, we call it the right-hand rule. All right? Now, what is going to be massively confusing to you is, I'm sorry, this is a bit of a touching moment. This is your first right-hand rule. It's a big moment. Anybody wants to come up for a picture? It's the first of many right-hand rules, okay? They all sort of come from the same thing, and I'll try to paint a picture of where it comes from, but in the end, you'll have a lot of little right-hand rules that you're going to have to sort of keep, little handy things to remember. So we're going to come back to that, but that gets us started for next time. This is Thursday, right? Have a great weekend.